Okay, if you open your Bibles, please, at the book of Esther, Esther chapter 2. You know how to find Esther, of course. The book of Psalms is right in the middle. And then you have Job before that. So Psalms is a bit like Waverley. Job is Haymarket. And I suppose Larbert would be Esther. On the railway line of Bible books. Later, when King X's fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. And then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Yahya, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the court of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the woman, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. This is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem, to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the Annals in the presence of the king. This is the word of God. It's inspired, it's inerrant, and it is the very breath of God himself. Well, first of all, the story. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction. And sometimes you read things in the Bible and it really stretches our sense of incredulity. But remember, the Bible was written in a very different culture, in a very different land to ours. So it's very, very hard to get your mind round it. Now, this would seem to be a very bizarre way to pick a queen. But really, as I was reading around this, it is not so bizarre. Our esteemed Italian Prime Minister, Mr. Berlusconi, or a former Prime Minister, picked a wife through going through a catalogue. And he saw the one he liked and he said, I'm going to have her. Paul McKenna, who is a kind of, what he is, life coach, magician, futurist, he gets a spreadsheet. And he does it in a really technical way as he looks for all the attributes of the perfect woman that he is going to court. And so, guys, that's the way to do it. Get working in the spreadsheets, look for all the attributes, and let the computer do the talking. And that's a great chat-up line. Hey, hen, you're my perfect spreadsheet. And then that will really... Get her juices flowing. So, it is weird out there. How you get a partner is absolutely bizarre, but there is nothing more bizarre than this convoluted beauty contest. Now, I have to say, right at the very beginning, again, think of the cultures here. This is not such a great deal for Queen Esther. What we're talking here, I think, is almost on the verge of people trafficking. It's almost on the verge of slavery. You would think that a year of beauty treatment, 6 months on cosmetics, and 6 months on perfume was a good deal. I don't know about you girls, but how would you feel about a guy who thinks that you need a year's preparation before you are fit to see the king? So this was a really bad deal, and we'll look about that a little bit later. So the story is very, very interesting. And again, as we go through the application, we'll look at some of the more sinister elements of this story later. I'm not going to keep you going too long tonight. It is Saturday night, and you will be somewhat tired. But we're not here tonight to hear about Berlusconi or how Paul McKenna got his significant other. We're here to hear about God. But again, I keep coming back to this question. Here's another angle to it. Where is God here? In World War II, there was a thing that wherever the American troops were to be found, there was graffiti all over the place. And you found that in Japan, you found it in Germany, you found it in walls everywhere. Kilroy was here. And it seemed that he was everywhere. Who was this Kilroy guy? And that's the main theme of Esther again. The God who is everywhere. I think one of our questions this morning was something like, why is God's name not mentioned? And the answer at one level is very simple. God did not want his name mentioned in the book of Esther. There is a reason for that. And there is no need to add his name. Now, when I was preparing this, I got a great quote from Spurgeon. See, Spurgeon. And he says this: although the name of God does not occur in the book of Esther, the Lord himself is there most conspicuously in every incident which it relates. I have seen portraits bearing the names of persons for whom they were intended, and they certainly needed them. But we have seen others which required no name because they were such striking likenesses that the moment you looked on them, you knew them. So if you see a portrait of Churchill, it does not have to have on the bottom of it Sir Winston Churchill or Bonnie Prince Charlie, because we kind of know who these people are. If you go look at any gable end of a Belfast wall, you will see a guy on a white horse. And it does not have to say, well, it usually does, King Billy. It is fairly obvious who he was. He was very, very famous, and everybody knows who he was. So it is in the book of Esther. He is so there that he does not need his name. And so that's the wonderful thing, that the God of the Bible, the God of Esther, is the great choreographer of our lives. That he is there, and as Schaeffer said, he is there, and he is not silent. And so we don't have to talk about the name of God all the time. God is not reserved simply for evangelical churches. God is in the whole world. And he's working things out. And that's what we give it the Sunday name of Providence. So that's how really good evangelicals never talk about luck. You know, they walk along the road and they just see a £50 note. They don't say, that's lucky. They say, this is a happy Providence. You know, because there's no luck. Young folk, you know, a few years ago, there was a kind of N-word, random. That's really random. Nothing is random. Everything. That fact that I tapped that desk has got some purpose. The detail is really important. And of course, this is recognised in philosophy and even science and chaos theory. You've got, you know, the butterfly effect. A butterfly flaps its wings and there is an earthquake in Italy. Now, obviously, that doesn't happen as a direct effect, but the point is that each little thing in a cumulative manner has an effect on the whole. And God is behind the butterfly, as he is behind, yet without sin, the earthquake. That's what we call providence. And so in the light of this is a very challenging chapter. If this were televised, it would be after the 9 o'clock watershed, wouldn't it? This fairly grubby recruitment campaign to get this young lady. So that's the story, very, very generally. So let's now apply it in various ways. And I've got 5 or 6 applications here. The first application is anger. Look at verse 1. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, anger. The king remembered what he'd done. Poor Vashti, he didn't kind of redeem her or bring her back. He remembered, but he seemed to think, oh, I've kind of misled a wife. You know, this is 3 years later. I haven't seen Vashti around for a long time. Oh yeah, I banished her because she disobeyed me. Ah, never mind, we'll get another one. I quite like Vashti. She was my favourite wife. But hey! But his fury, he was angry. The red mist comes down. Now I wonder, do some of you suffer from anger? And when the red mist goes down, we really are not responsible for our actions. And some of us have a greater propensity to anger and losing our temper than others. And it's not just a mere personality flaw. Not just because you've got red hair. Excuse anyone who's ginger. Folks here, get red hair so you're fiery. And of course, the great thing is, the red-haired folk wouldn't take offence at that, because if they do take offence, it proves the point, doesn't it? So they're very calm. Although they're seething inside. Some folk have a propensity to anger, and other folks don't. Xerxes was furious, and his fury made him make a decision. I'm not sure if he regrets that decision, but let's analyse our anger. We're looking at the issue of righteous anger and unrighteous anger. What's the difference between the two? Anger is kind of raised here. Another thing that's raised is what I've called by recovery by more sin. I think the king was trapped. I think the language implies regret. There's this law of the Medes and the Persians thing. It's a decree which could not be changed. One commentator says, of course it could be changed. Anything can be changed. He was a king. He was an autocrat. But some say, well, even he was bound by the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Now, 4 years, rather, had passed. A lot of water had gone under the bridge. Apparently, he had fought a war with the Greeks in the intervening 4 years, and he had experienced a humiliating defeat, and he lost many national treasures. So for a king, that was really bad. A lot of the national treasures went, the national debt, I suppose, economically, was big. He was losing popularity, he'd lost a war, things weren't going very, very, very well at all. So what he did was, he sought comfort, and we know this from external writings. King Xerxes then, in this intervening 4 years, sought comfort in serial, superficial relationships, mostly with his officers' wives. And apparently, King Xerxes was ultimately himself assassinated while being caught in the bedroom of one of his officers' wives. So King Xerxes was himself serially immoral. The point I'm making there was that he was in a bad place, and you cannot sin yourself out of a bad place. Serial superficial relationships bring no lasting joy. Now that may or may not be relevant here. God did not design us this way. We were built. We were made for monogamy. We were built, that's a reflection for companionship. We were building a plan of the Trinity. But we know, again from his external sources, that Xerxes did not learn his lesson. He had no moral compass. But there's a third thing there, application, and that is that godlessness leads to a brutal society. So we have King Xerxes here, and he is the king of Persia and Media. He is a king of this godless society, of a pagan society. So his advisors come up with an idea, verse 2. I don't know if you remember, those of you who are a little bit older, yes, minister. Well, that's what we have here in verse 2. The king's personal attendants, the civil service, were called in. And the king says, we need a new queen. And so the civil service come in, and they come up with what was probably the most popular civil service advice ever. And it's actually quite funny. Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners. Let them have beauty treatments. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the end of verse 4 must be the most understated verse in the whole Bible. This advice appealed to the king. And he followed it. This was Christmas come early. It wasn't obviously into Christmas. It was ridiculous. Take the most beautiful woman in the land, prepare them with perfume and cosmetics, and then they would spend one night with the king. Isn't that, I think there's a popular book out there on Esther, One Night with the King. And that's all she had, one night with the king. Now, it may seem glamorous, but as I said, to be in the queen's or the king's harem was a nightmare. I don't know if you ever dream or speculate what it would be like to have all the money that you could ever have. I often wonder, you know, when William and Harry were growing up, did Harry one day say, hey, Wills, come here. Have you noticed something? Huh? We're different. What do you mean we're different? Well, Granny's photos and all the stamps. She's not all the money. Oh, fair enough. I never thought of that. Yeah, there's all these weird people around, sort of, you know, doing everything for us. Hey, you might be right. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to be a royal? I think it would be a really, really hard situation. William and Kate, do they have a charmed life? Yeah, in many ways, but in many ways it's a prison, it's a velvet ditch. Nice ditch, but, you know, Kate can't do coffee with her friends from St. Andrews at Starbucks anymore. She just can't do that. This is so much worse than that. You were part of a harem of thousands. You were separated from everybody. You had no chance of having children. You know, one night, okay, you do the math. The statistical possibility of her getting pregnant was not high. No other relationships with anybody else. No children. And it wasn't much better for the poor guys who looked after them. You know, they were selected to become eunuchs in the king's service. You know, that's a great job application. The good news is you're working for the king. The bad news is, well, I'm just not going to go there. But it's not really very pleasant, I imagine, being a eunuch. I think there's an application there. The morality, the values of this pagan society are brutal. I'm a Facebook friend with a guy who was in school with me, and he's really irreligious. And his one of his things are the brutality of Christians. And he's one of these guys who thinks that Scotland is overrun and ruled by dark, repressive Calvinists, and it's really awful. And I said to him once, you know, what about, you know, he's an absolute atheist. So what do you guys have to show? North Korea? You know, I don't really see many folk going in package holidays run by Thompsons to North Korea. It's a society without God. It's an absolutely horrible place. It's monochrome. It's terrible. Nazi Germany, ancient Rome. One of the questions to discuss is that as Christian influence and morality and the Ten Commandments are excised from Scottish national life, is Scotland becoming a more tolerant, open, inclusive, pleasant society? It's not very inclusive for the unborn child, is it? It's not very inclusive for people who have genuine scruples and principles of sexuality and morality. It's not very forgiving. So it was a horrible, it was a brutal regime. So for this kind of pamper party, read human trafficking. It's horrible. This is a natural extension of Xerxes' godless philosophy and worldview. But into this situation comes Esther. And that moves us on to another issue here, raising godly children. Now, maybe we're reading too much into this, but I think, taking the context of the whole book of Esther was a good girl. And I think one of the fascinating things I'm finding about Esther is there's all these angles. You know, was Esther a model of a principled, godly girl? Or was she a backslider who was suddenly pushed into a situation which eventually made her return to the Lord? I don't know. It's worthy of much discussion. But into this situation came Esther, also known as Hadassah. And from all accounts, she was a good girl. Again, that needs to be unpacked. She was part of a Jewish exile. She was living with her relative uncle. I don't know, the relationship is somewhat ambiguous. Mordecai. Now, I think this is fascinating. This is a girl's world. Esther was raised by an older man, her uncle. Don't underestimate the influence of bringing up children. It's a fairly obvious application here. Even in difficult situations, Mordecai was a single parent bringing up a girl. It must have been really difficult and really challenging for him. But don't forget also the resources that God can bring to difficult situations. Some of you may be single parents bringing up children. Some of you may be in difficult family circumstances. Again, I don't know your stories. You don't know mine. But she was forsaken by her parents. They died. The Lord took her up. There's an interesting word in verse 7. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. I'm told that the language group there in the original brought up means supported and believed in. There was affirmation there that it's a very good concept that the child was supported and affirmed. He nurtured Esther and helped her grow in character and poise, as we will see later. Raising kids, wow. Seriously, it's a great job. It is so significant. Being a child is significant. Opportunities, wonderful. But what else do we see here? I think we see here that God's people are found in the most unlikely places. I think it's legitimate to ask, what is a good girl doing in this situation? Well, she didn't have much chance. She was taken. Okay, she was taken. Beauty treatments, lots of oil of Yule, looking in, physical value dominates. Looking in, there's no God, there's no values, there's no godly people. Mordecai is on the outside, he's looking in, he takes that walk, doesn't he? Trying to get a glimpse of Esther. She's on her own in the harem. And yet there she is. She is a believer in Jehovah. She is a covenant child in a really difficult situation. But God is there with us. God is there at work. God is at work in Aleppo, in Syria. God is at work in the former jungle in Cali. God is at work in Afghanistan. God is at work in the situation which is your home environment, your work environment, which is godless. God is still there. Perhaps the greatest example of God at work in a bad place is the cross, the darkened sky, the brutal soldiers, the swearing, the cursing, the sheer atmosphere of brutality. You would see looking in, where is God there? He's in the middle of it. He was never as strong as he was on the cross. This is bigger than the story of a woman raised by God for a specific purpose. This is God moving on in this really difficult place. God is still there. She is still there. God's people are in the most unlikely places. At the cross you see a dictator and bad advisors, and yet God is there. We live in a secular age, but God does not do secular. There may be moral failure even, Now, that is not excuse, and it is inexcusable, but God even works through that. Be careful where you judge, where you see God's people, because they are found in the most weird places. Next application is that we see God's people here without labels, verse 10. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background. I don't do labels. I don't do WWJD wristbands, apologies if anybody's got them. Carefully pushing them up their sleeve. Or fish symbols in the back of cars. I don't do that. If you saw my driving, you'd know exactly why I don't do it. I don't wear my Christianity on my sleeve, literally. Esther did not reveal her background. Strength? Weakness? Was she a mere pragmatist? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Why did Mordecai say that? Was he pragmatic? If you tell them you're a Jew, that will scupper your chances of ever being queen. Did he fear anti-Semitism? Did he have a genuine concern for the girl? That if she was revealed to have been one of the people of God, that she would be, you know, brutalized. Sometimes it's best not to speak. Proverbs 13:3. He who guards his lips guards his life, but he who speaks rashly will come to ruin. Verbal restraint is a great thing. I'm not saying you should be quiet about your faith. Romans says, confess with your mouths. But Matthew Henry said a very interesting thing. He said, all truths are not to be spoken before... Sorry. All truths are not to be spoken at all times. You don't always have to speak the truth. Let me unpack that. You see somebody and they've got a facial characteristic that is weird. I've had a quick check around the room and I can use this illustration because there's nobody who's got this. Imagine someone has got like a huge nose. I've got the biggest. Huge nose. And you meet them and say, whew, you've got a huge nose. It's true. But you don't need to say it. That's what I mean. But we do not always have to tell the truth. Younger, I'm not saying you tell lies, but you don't always have to say that. You're big. It's time to speak and a time to be silent. All truths are not to be spoken at all times. Sometimes you don't need the overt badge, the overt label. God's people without label. And sometimes when you put the label on, you leave yourself as a hostage to fortune. We'll discuss that later. But there are many elements of her life which pointed to her being different. She was biddable, she had a teachable spirit. But I think Esther was special. And that brings me on to the next point. The nature of beauty. In chapter 2, verse 9, there's a lovely expression there. She pleased him. She's talking about how the keeper of the harem saw her. She pleased him and won his favour. Literally, that means she lifted up grace before his face. There was just something about Esther that was from another world. And I think it was her Jewish upbringing, her values, her God-fearing nature, just her upbringing, the stamp of a child of the covenant on her. And one of the great things about a covenantal view of children, and one of the great things about infant baptism, for example, is it is not how we feel about God, but it's how God feels about us which is more important. And God felt a great thing about Esther. She lifted up grace before his face. The king, the keeper of the harem, both of these folk were attracted by her beauty. What is beauty? It's a great question. Are we working on our beauty? There's a book by a lady called Joan Brumberg, and it's called The Body Project. And it contrasts how girls saw themselves 100 years ago compared to the way they see themselves today. And what it does is it analyses diaries from 100 years ago to diaries today kept by girls. I don't know if people keep diaries anymore. I used to keep a diary till someone read it once. Never again. Dear diary, it was really embarrassing. Listen to this excerpt from a diary from 1892. This is a girl, teenage girl, writing in 1892. Dear diary, today resolved to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversations and actions, to be dignified, interesting myself more in others. 100 years on, a diary in 1982. Girl writes, I will try to make myself better in every way I possibly can with the help of my babysitting money. I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got a new haircut, good makeup and accessories. 100 years ago, a girl and boy would die if someone saw their diary. Now, a guy and a girl will scream if someone doesn't see their diary and put a like on Facebook, or I think Facebook's passé now, but whatever the new thing is. What's beauty? Beauty is not the ultimate expression of the self, but the ultimate resting in God, seeing the beauty of God. Beauty is truly within, and I think Esther had beauty without and beauty within. John Piper says, the diaries which express the glory of God in the future will most likely be written from Calcutta rather from the comfortable houses in America. And Esther had the same stature and spirit of Jesus had, and with this I will conclude. It said of Jesus that he grew in stature and wisdom and increased in favour with men and with God. Guys, girls, young, old, that's what beauty is. This Esther-like beauty, which was more than outward. It was that inward beauty which the world cannot give, but the world cannot take away. Be very patient. Let's just pray. Father, we thank you for your word. We pray tonight that you would help us as we continue to study it together, and that we would be encouraging, edifying each other in you. Amen.